Is there such a thing as a just war, and how might we recognize it? Today on Principles and Policies. Hello and welcome to Principles and Policies. I'm your acting host today, Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. Well, today, once again, we're going to do a show that's a sample class from Camp American. Now, these sample classes are essentially audios that have been recorded during class periods at Camp American. And we're doing this to show you the caliber of instructors and the methods of instruction, the very different methods of instruction that we see from the different teachers at Camp American. Last week you heard Tom DeWeese, who gave a straight lecture. Now you're going to hear from a guy who, shall we say, can be a little intimidating as a teacher, but he does it in the name of teaching you how to think very fast on your feet. And one thing you do get from this teacher is the ability to think very quickly on your feet, because if you don't, well, he doesn't do anything to you, but it's very intimidating. I can tell you that this method of teaching is actually very highly effective. And personally, I have used it a little bit, and it works. And you're going to hear it work today. Now, the teacher we're going to be hearing from is Dr. Charles Rice. Now, some of you who are familiar with the pro-life movement will recognize the name of Dr. Rice. Dr. Charles Rice is a professor emeritus of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School in Notre Dame, Indiana. Now, he specializes in constitutional law, or he did specialize in constitutional law when he was teaching. He is, of course, retired now. Also in jurisprudence and torts. He has numerous degrees. He has a BA from Holy Cross, a Juris Doctor from Boston College Law School, and an LLM and JSD from New York University. He has a very diverse background, and he can speak about things military because he served in the Marine Corps and is a Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve. So he's not clueless on things military. Now, he practiced law in New York City, taught at New York University Law School and Fordham Law School, and then joined Notre Dame in 1969. So again, no slouch in the teaching department or in the degree department. Now, he's also been a member of the Education Appeal Board of the United States Department of Education. He served as a consultant to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and to various congressional committees on constitutional issues, and is an editor of the American Journal of Jurisprudence. He's also a member of the governing boards of Ave Maria Law School, Franciscan University over at Steubenville, and the Eternal Word Television Network, EWTN. Some of you may have heard of that. He's also the director of Thomas More Center for Law and Justice in Ann Arbor, which provides legal defense for persons who exercise constitutional rights with respect to abortion, education, and other issues. Again, no slouch in the pro-life department. And again, those of you who have heard of Charles Rice have probably heard of him in connection with his pro-life activities. He's written books, lots and lots of books, Freedom of Association, the Supreme Court and Public Prayer, The Vanishing Right to Live, Authority and Rebellion Beyond Abortion, The Theory and Practice of the Secular State, No Exception, A Pro-Life Imperative, and 50 Questions on the Natural Law. His latest book, as of the time that the bio that I have was written, was The Winning Side, Questions on Living the Cultural Life, published by St. Brendan's Institute in 2000. Well, as you can see, Dr. Rice is involved, and even in his retirement, he's still involved, because he's still going around and teaching in places like Camp American. And believe me, we are happy to get teachers like Charles Rice. And all our teachers are of a caliber of this type. Now, Dr. Rice also, just to keep things interesting, is a faculty advisor and an assistant coach of the Notre Dame Boxing Club. So he can be an intimidating individual. But he is also a great guy. Having conversed with him on several occasions, he is one of the nicest men I've ever met. And he's also one of the most knowledgeable. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Well, it doesn't have much to do with the class we're going to listen in on today. But what Dr. Rice will do is run kids through an exercise in which he teaches them to think critically. And he teaches them to think critically very fast. And the issue we're going to be listening in on today is just war theory. Now, this class was taught at Camp American in 2007. And as you will hear, he snaps the questions off pretty fast, but his reasoning, the reasoning that he uses is what we're really interested in getting at. You will find no greater reasoner than Dr. Rice, and he will lay the argument out and show the kids. This is what the important part is. He is showing the students how to lay the arguments out for themselves and how to deal with questions that come fast and furious when you're in one of these public debates. And to that end, I would suggest holding on to your hats, because it'll be kind of a fast and furious ride with Dr. Charles Rice. So without further ado, here is Dr. Charles Rice teaching on just war.
Constitution, right? When was it adopted? Huh? Yeah. When was the Constitutional Convention? Where was it? Indianapolis? Where was it? Yeah? Okay. What does the Constitution say about war? All right, let's just talk about it a little bit, and then we'll get into the question of the just war and that kind of thing. The Constitutional Convention, when they were discussing the war power of the President and of Congress, Congress has a war power, and the President has a war power. Right? And in discussing this, the original wording that they had was to give to Congress the power, now watch this language, to, quote, make or declare, unquote, war. To make or declare war. And then they changed it, and they dropped the words make or, so that they just gave Congress the power to declare war. And the reason, as James Madison said, was that we want to leave to the President the power to, as he put it, quote, repel sudden attacks, unquote. So that was the breakdown. Congress would declare war. What does that mean? Well, even at that time, formal declarations of war were becoming less common. We have only declared war 5 times in our history. And the last time Congress debated whether to go to war, whether to actually declare war, and to put the, the last time Congress actually made the decision was in 1917 in World War One. I'll explain that later on. But the idea was that the President would have the power to repel sudden attacks, and Congress retained the ability to make the big decision as to whether the United States would go to war, right? And over the course of our history, the presidents have put the armed forces into action over 200 times. Virtually without exception, they have had congressional approval before they did it, or they went and got approval after they did it. One exception was President Clinton's bombing of Kosovo, which he did despite the fact that Congress forbade it, which is kind of interesting. So that's the constitutional breakdown. Now, declaration of war, as I say, has become kind of obsolete. And what is, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but what has kind of stepped into its place is Congress making a resolution. And this is what happened in the Iraq War. It's what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Vietnam. In the Gulf of Tonkin, there was a supposed attack on United States forces in the Gulf of Tonkin, which turned out later to have not occurred. And Congress passed a resolution saying the president is authorized to take military action. And that was the legal basis for the Vietnam, for our military operation in Vietnam. That was the initial legal basis. Later on, of course, Congress appropriated money for it. Now, what's this development? Later in the Vietnam War, when the peace movement, so-called peace movement, was gaining ground, Congress had a movement in Congress to repeal the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was the resolution by Congress authorizing the president to fight in Vietnam. And Congress was considering repealing that. And the Nixon administration at first objected to that, objected to the repeal. And then they changed their mind. And the Nixon administration then said, we don't care what you do, because we have inherent executive power to conduct this war. Which is really kind of interesting. There's never been a real resolution of this impasse. The Constitution left a lot of things open to political resolution, and this is one of them. The courts have not decided this, and the Supreme Court is not the exclusive authority here. Each branch has authority to determine what the Constitution means. So, in the Korean War, you had the UN resolution, and you had Congress supporting that. There's no declaration of war. And in the first Gulf War, you had a congressional resolution, and in the second, in the Iraq War, you had a congressional resolution, which gave to the president, said the president is authorized to take such action as he sees fit. I mean, the Congress gave to the president essentially a blank check to decide whether to go to war in the first Gulf War and in Iraq, and as well as in Afghanistan after 9/11. So the question of who decides whether to go to war, you got to do some real thinking about this. And I suggest to you that what the Constitution intended, and it was sound in doing this, was that the big decision whether the United States would go into a war would be made by the representatives of the people who would fight the war. That the big decision, will we go to war, apart from attacks, sudden attacks, that kind of thing. Definitely, clearly, the intent of the Constitution was that that kind of decision would be made by the Congress. That's why they reserved to Congress the power to declare war. And whether, in the form of a declaration or not, the real question is who actually decides whether we go to war. The congressional resolutions in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as in the first Gulf War, put that decision in the president. Right? Congress essentially passed the buck to the president and said, we vote to authorize the president to decide whether to go to war. In my opinion, that is contrary to the intent of the Constitution. The intent of the Constitution clearly was not that the president would have the decision whether Congress authorized it or not, not that the president would have the decision whether to go to war, but the intent clearly was that that decision would be by the Congress. And be careful about this. What I'm talking about here is not the decision whether to authorize the president. I'm talking about the decision by Congress to say, yes, we're going to war. That's why several congressmen, Congressman Jones and others, have introduced bills in Congress which are very sound constitutional bills, which say that before the president does anything on Iran, that the president must go to Congress and get specific approval, yes, attack Iran. And that is a constitutionally sound bill. Of course, it's going nowhere in the Congress. But that's the constitutional background of this thing. Now, next question is, okay, what's this business about war? Can a war be just? I mean, remember that justice means that it's right, morally right, that it's treating people as they should be treated. Can a war be just? Can you ever have a moral right to go to war? What do you think? No? Let me give you an example. 1939, the Soviet Union attacked Finland. Finland is geographically a big country, but militarily they're not a big power. And the Soviet army was huge. And they invaded Finland. Did the Finns have a right to resist them? Yes, of course. Did the Finns have a right, therefore, to go to war? Yeah, sure. Of course they did. As it turned out, they fought the Soviets to a standstill and kept their country relatively free. It was an amazing performance. The Finns were fighting in their turf on in the snow and all the rest of that. Sure, there can be a just war. Of course there can. No further question is whether there can be a preemptive war, whether that can be just. And that's a very serious question. Let me give you the theory on it, all right? St. Augustine, who back around 500, started laying out the requirements for a just war. And what is the just war doctrine? It's a doctrine that kind of tries to limit the harm caused by war by saying that there are only certain times you can go to war, and then saying what you can do in the war. St. Augustine was the one who began to develop the just war theory. And St. Thomas Aquinas followed up on that in the 13th century. And the principles here are quite clear. For a just war, the first thing you got to have is proper authority. You got to have proper authority. Who can go to war? Who can start a war? Who's got the right to go to war? Huh? As a director of Camp Pokagon, suppose the director of Camp Pokagon, Freddie Glotz, whatever his name is, were to come in here and announce, I want to tell you guys that Pokagon State Park has just declared war on France. What's the first thing you say? Huh? What's the first thing you say? You say, hey, Freddie, yeah, that's beyond your authority, all right? So a war is something that can be carried on only by the state. A private person, incidentally, never, ever intentionally has the right to kill anybody. What about self-defense? You have a right of self-defense? Really? So are you intentionally killing? Huh? Who are you? Yeah, who are you? Clay? All right, Clay is coming at you with a knife, all right? What's your name? Huh? Kathleen? The only way Kathleen can save her life is to ventilate Clay with her .45 right between the eyes, all right? Can you do it? You can do it, right? Huh? Yes, it's the only way you can do it is the total Clay, all right? Did you intend to kill him? Huh? Clay, what about it? You're room temperature now, but what about it? Does she have a right to do that? Yeah, she has a right to do that, but she has a moral right to do it. Pursuant to a very, very important principle, which is the principle of the double effect, which we're going to see later on. And that principle is that there are some actions that you can take morally which have two effects. One is good, one is bad. Kathleen is taking an action which is good. What's the action? Defending herself, defending her life, that's good. That's the first requirement. The action has to be good. Second, there has to be a sufficient reason to take the risk of harming Clay. What's the sufficient reason? Clay's going to turn out her lights, all right? And she has no duty to subordinate her life to his. And the third thing is that she must not intend to kill Clay. Now, the law doesn't get into that in detail, all right? The law would give her a free pass no matter what her internal intent was, pretty much. But morally, if Clay is coming at her and Kathleen says, wow, I finally have the chance to rid the world of Clay. All right? She intends to kill him. She can't do it. So the double effect requires that she not intend the bad effect. And the fourth thing, keep these in mind because we're going to talk about them with reference to war later on. The fourth thing is that the good result, she saves her life, is not achieved by means of the bad result, he dies. Her life is not saved because he died. Her life is saved because he was stopped. And her intent has to be to stop him, all right? Yeah. Cops. I mean, there's no such thing as a cop who's not authorized by the state, even private cops, all right? So the cops have the power of the state. The state derives its authority from God, and the state has authority intentionally to kill in two circumstances. One, the just war, and law enforcement, and two, capital punishment. So the cop is a different story from Kathleen. Well, Clay is, after she ventilates him right here, he's no longer alive. Her intent is not to kill him. Her intent has to be to stop him. Right? And normally, and this is a very important principle. You got to keep it in mind because, you know, think about it. The intent can't be to cause the bad result that is he dies, because she doesn't have authority to intentionally to kill him, but she has authority intentionally to stop him, even though it results in his death. Yeah. Okay, good. Hey, it's good. Let's get back into the just war thing, because we're going to deal with this later on, right? That's good. A really good question. Hold on. So St. Augustine began this, and Thomas and the general Christian tradition developed this theory. So you need proper authority, you need the right intention, and you need a just cause, a sufficient cause. You can't go to war for a trivial reason. And you need the right intention. You can't go to war for the purpose of exterminating another people, but rather to right an injustice or prevent an injustice, that kind of thing. Other requirements have been added generally, but these are more or less incorporated in those three. For example, that war must be the last resort. That, one requirement is proportionality, that the war be proportionate. You can't go to war over a trivial insult, but that's the same thing as just cause. Right? And those are the requirements for what... I'm going to throw Latin at you, all right? Have any of you guys, by any chance, ever taken Latin? No kidding. Great. All right. Jus. What does that mean? J-U-S. You can get an idea. It doesn't mean juice. What does it mean? J-U-S. Anybody know? Who took Latin here? What does it mean? Yeah, justice. Jus in bello. B-E-L-L-O. That doesn't mean to shout. What does it mean? War. Justice in war. Those, the three requirements for justice in war are those: proper authority, just cause, right intention. Then you have, you know, last resort, the proportionality, all the rest of it. Then you have jus ad bellum. I beg your pardon. I'm sorry. Those first three are jus ad bellum. That is, ad means going to, bellum means war. Justice in going to war, you must have those three things. Proper authority, it has to be the state. Right intention, and just cause. Then you have jus in bello, that is justice in war. What can you do in war? And there are two requirements here. One is proportionality. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you have to restrict yourself to the same levels of force that your enemy has. No. You can use overwhelming force. But if there's an enemy PX, a post exchange, a little store in a town, you can't nuke the town in order to take out that store. I mean, that's just a violation of proportionality. All right? So you have those two things, jus ad bellum, justice in going to war, and then jus in bello, how do you conduct it? Now, what about rebellion? Is there a right to rebel? Huh? No? When are you going to renounce your American citizenship? Huh? How did we get into business as a country? Why do they call it? Tell me what it was. It was the American fill in the blank. What do they call it? Begins with R. R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. American Revolution, right? So is there a right to rebel? Yeah? Whenever you want to, right? Whenever you want to, right? No kidding. Joe Schmatz can go out here and decide, hey, I don't like this country. I'm going to get my friends and we're going to secede. And we're going to establish the nation of Pokagon, all right? And we're going to declare war on the United States. Surrender and apply for foreign aid, right? Can you rebel? Yes, there's a right to rebellion. Of course there is. But you know what you're doing when you assert the moral right to rebellion? What you're doing is asserting the right to take over the authority of the state. And it's not inconsistent. The fact that there's a right of rebellion under very restrictive circumstances is not inconsistent with the principle that only the state has authority to wage war. In terms of war. And rebellion is much more difficult to justify. One of the requirements there is that they can't do more harm than good. The reason it's much more difficult to justify is because rebellion is a do-it-yourself operation. And it's not conducted by the proper authority. But it's a really kind of a do-it-yourself operation. So sure, there is a right of rebellion. And the just war requirements have been developed over the centuries. Now, let me tell you one of the problems before we get into discussing it. One of the problems is what has come to be known as fourth-generation warfare. And that is that, and this developed in a series of articles back in the 1980s and has been continuing. And it originated in the Marine Corps Gazette, as a matter of fact, the magazine of the Marine Corps. And fourth-generation warfare, William Lind and others have discussed it, is a new kind of war. The first-generation warfare, they say, was back, for example, back in our Revolutionary War, or before that, even. Well, the armies would get up there and they'd walk against each other, they'd stop, they'd shoot each other, they'd all fall down. All right? Napoleon's wars and the wars of the 17th century. Second generation warfare was where people got into trenches. Our Civil War and the First World War. And they fought static war from trenches. Third generation war was, they say, was a war of mobility. The Second World War was war of mobility through air power, tanks, and so on, where armies were moving. The fourth generation warfare is 9/11. The fourth generation warfare is non-state warfare. Non-state warfare, where it is not the state that's conducting hostilities. It has become a private enterprise operation. And the rules that have been developed to govern warfare, the Geneva Conventions, for example, are rules that provide protection for members of armed forces who fight in uniforms so you can recognize them, who fight under rules. And that really doesn't apply to the Taliban and so forth. So you have that problem. And one of the difficulties after 9/11, when did that happen? Yeah, what date? Yeah, good thinking, all right? After 9/11, President Bush got up there and said, we're at war. Against whom? All right? So it's been called a war on terror. And one of the problems in understanding that is, well, wait a minute, who's the enemy? The German technique, the German tactic in World War II was blitzkrieg, you know, sudden attack by armored forces. Saying a war on terror is like saying a war on blitzkrieg. It doesn't make any sense. So one of the difficulties is identifying the enemy. But now, whether you're dealing with fourth generation warfare or traditional warfare between states, whether you're doing that, whether you're doing either one of those, it's important to focus on the two requirements for jus in bello, that is justice in war. And they are proportionality and, most important, discrimination. What does that mean? What do you think that means? Huh? Of what? From the war? You mean discrimination? You got this justified target, all right? It's a, suppose it's a missile site in Vietnam or wherever it might be, or over there. It's a place where they have IEDs stored, all right? Can you attack it? Yes, you can attack it. And we have made a legitimate effort to be very restrictive in our targeting in Iraq, but you can never have total success there. Suppose you know that in taking out that target, you are going to take out civilians. Can you do it? Let's go back to Kathleen and Clay. It's the principle of the double effect. The destruction of the missile site or whatever it is, the IED factory, is a good act, right? Second, it's justified because it's very important to take it out. Third, the bad result is that the civilians die. You don't intend that. You can't intend that. And the good result, taking out the missile or the site or the silo or whatever it is, the good result is not achieved because the civilians died. It's not achieved by that end. And one of the problems is proportionality. You have to make the judgment, and these are very difficult calls. Is there a sufficient reason? And we've had the experience in the Middle East and in Vietnam, particularly of the bad guys putting civilians as shields before legitimate targets. And you have serious questions there. There are questions where it's very difficult. I mean, it's really not fair to second-guess military decisions. We now know, for example, that in the Haditha prosecution of the Marines, which is now still going on. They now have released the intelligence reports. We now know that that was a planned ambush. We now know that the bad guys blocked the convoy by exploding an IED. Intelligence report said that there was going to be a white station wagon involved, a white SUV, actually. And there was, with eight guys in it, and the Marines opened fire on the SUV. Killed the eight guys. And then from either side of the street, from the houses, there was fire on the Marine convoy. That was the ambush. They would be blocked by the SUV and by the explosion of the IED, which killed one Marine. The Marines attacked the houses from which they were being shot at. And the bad guys had civilian shields in those houses. They had civilians in those houses. I'm not making this up. This is now out in the, these reports. I know one of the lawyers who was defending one of those Marines. And the bad guys had civilians. They deliberately put civilians in those houses. And as the Marines charged the houses, all but two of the bad guys left. Went out the back door. As the Marines came in, you got six people, you got eight people there. And as you're being shot at from that group of eight people, there are actually only two bad guys there shooting. But what judgment are you going to make? They're being shot at by these people. And that's why that prosecution should never have been brought and probably will not go anywhere. You understand you have to make difficult decisions. But what you can't do is intentionally kill known civilians, known non-combatants. You can't do that. Which raises questions about the bombing in World War II. The bombing of Dresden, for example. Dresden is a beautiful old city in eastern Germany. And Dresden is here. The Soviet forces are coming. And the refugees are filling Dresden. Dresden, although some have tried to argue otherwise, had no military significance. This was February 1945, the closing weeks of the war. The British Bomber Command and the American 8th Air Force actually, at the decision of the British Bomber Command, made the decision. Now, think about this. They made the decision to create a firestorm in Dresden. This was February 1945. The surrender was not until May. They wanted to create a firestorm in Dresden to cause great civilian casualties so that the population of Germany would put pressure on the Nazi regime to end the war. And that is different from this kind of thing, because that is an intentional targeting of people who are not under any condition describable as combatants. I mean, they were not. That was an atrocity. Yeah. Good question. I was going to bring that up. These are questions where you got to put your brain in gear and think about these things. In Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the arguments were that if you drop the A-bomb, it will prevent an invasion and save millions of lives. That is the direct attack, if that is what it was, which is what Dresden was. If that is what it was a direct attack on civilians, which you can't do. Period, paragraph. There's no dispute, no doubt about who the civilians, whether they were combatants. We're not even talking about the example of the factory workers who could arguably be considered combatants. You see? Who is a non-combatant today? Well, certainly refugees are non-combatants. The arguments were made with respect to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I'm not capable of answering that question. It's a fact question. And the arguments were made, well, there were industries scattered throughout those cities, and there were legitimate targets there. That's a separate question, right? And what is clear is that if you're talking about targeting known non-combatants, you can't do it for any reason. But the difficulty is in defining and determining who fits that description. See? In modern warfare, who is a combatant? Now, if you're going to define every taxpayer as a combatant, then you got a bad situation. But you see the difficulty, the just war principles will give you the framework from which to analyze these things, and there are difficult questions that are involved. And there are some clear things that you can't ever do. And one of them is that you can never intentionally kill the innocent. However, remember the double effect, right? Remember Kathleen and Clay, that there are circumstances under which you can take a justified action, even though you know it will result in a bad result, provided you don't intend the bad result, and provided that you didn't achieve the good by means of the bad result. So these are really interesting questions. I've got a little book on it. I recently wrote a book on these things with Teresa Farnan, who happens to be my daughter. And it's related to these questions. It's called "Where Did I Come From? Where Am I Going? How Do I Get There?" And you can get it at Amazon or various places. But think about these things. The most important thing to do about the just war is to relate it back to what we talked about in the first hour. That is, what makes things right or wrong. And you relate it back particularly to the commandments. Because the fact that you're in a war does not liberate you from the law of God. And does not liberate you from the commandments and the natural law. So that's why you have to look at these things in the context of God's law as well as the human law. Okay? Any questions on it? Okay. Listen, let me just say before we wrap up that this is a great program, and I hope hope you get others to come to it. I think just being able to get the exposure that you're getting to good stuff. I mean, what you're learning here is good stuff, and you're learning it in the proper context. I think it's a great opportunity. I regard it as a high privilege to come down here, and even though I had to wait for a cup of coffee, but I think it was, I really regard it as a high privilege to be here. And I think it's, I talk about this often, you know, that the quality of the group down here is exceptional. So keep doing what you're doing. Most important, keep praying. We are on the winning side. God is not dead. He's not even tired. Okay? So, thank you very much.
Wow. Now, was that not a rather fast ride through just war theory? He covered an amazing amount of ground in 1 hour. And this is the way we do things at Camp American because, let's face it, your kids are in school. Very often, many of you, your kids are in public schools. They get your kids 9 months a year, 6 hours a day. We get 1 week a year, about 4 hours a day, and not counting recreation time because, let's face it, the kids are working hard. They've got to have some recreation time. We've got to hit them hard and hit them with a Christian worldview hard, especially those kids that are in public school. Now, of course, we have a lot of kids who are in homeschool. But even some homeschool curriculums don't hit some of these items with the same depth and the same kind of detail that you just heard Dr. Rice give at Camp American. Now, obviously, we're not testing kids. We're not doing testing. So you don't know how much of it they're absorbing. But remember that we very often repeat classes because there are kids who come to Camp American who are, for instance, maybe 12 years old. Well, will a 12-year-old be able to understand what they heard in a class like that as well as one of the 17 or 18-year-olds? Well, no. But if they come back 3 years after they've heard this and they've had some time to mull that over and think about some of the things they heard and ask questions internally about some of the things they didn't understand and they hear it again, then what do you know? All of a sudden, the understanding clicks in and they have a very firm grasp on the subject. And we do that a lot. For instance, this year I will be teaching a class that I taught 4 years ago. Will we have some campers that we had 4 years ago that heard this presentation? Oh, there will be a few. There will be a few who heard this 4 years ago who will hear it again. But this time, very many of them will have a very different viewpoint because they're a little older. They're 4 years older. They're closer to voting. Some of them, in fact, will be voting for the first time that were there 4 years ago. And they will understand the system as I'm teaching it on the Electoral College and what the original intent of the Electoral College was, how the system has been broken, because let's face it, folks, the system is very broken right now. It doesn't work the way the Founding Fathers designed it to work. And if you want to know how, then you wait till we get the recording of this out and you can buy a copy. I have an old copy that we recorded years ago that, as far as I'm concerned, is not worthy of using as a teaching tool. So we're going to re-record it this year and make it available. And that'll probably be available, I don't know, around the first of next year or so. I realize it's a little late. Maybe we'll try to get that one out early for the election. Sometimes it takes a little time to edit these videos and put all the front and back parts on it and those kinds of things. But that being said, we have all kinds of classes for all kinds of purposes that are coming to Camp American this year. Now, we've had a number of people who have asked us questions about how do we sign up? How do we register? How can we come to Camp American? How can we get a reservation? Well, actually, that's a lot easier than you might think. First of all, you go to our Camp American webpage. That's www.campamerican.com. Don't go to campamerica.com, because if you go to campamerica.com, you will get a camping supply store, which will give you things that you might be able to use at Camp American, but it will not allow you to register for classes. So go to campamerican.com, and you'll see on the front page, you will see off to the right a thing called store categories. Now, that is a place where you can pay your fee. If you look down, you will see a list that says books, family tuition packages, group tuition packages, individual tuition packages. Go to, if you are a single student, go to individual tuition packages. Click on that and a webpage will open up and it will allow you to use a credit card to put down a down payment to reserve your spot at Camp American. If you'd rather pay it in full, there's also an option to pay the tuition in full, and that's on the page as well. Now, if you go to that page and you'll look up at the top, you'll see a special new tuition offer. Don't forget about this. If you want to come to camp and you want to come to camp at no cost, don't kid yourself. There's some work involved in this. There's a special new tuition offer where you can come for free if you can get three of your friends who paying tuition to come to camp, you get to come for free. Sometimes that's better for campers who have been to camp once and know more about it. But very often, if you're ambitious, you can recruit three other people to come, pay full tuition. And by full, I mean the early bird tuition, because right now we have a special. If you go down to the third choice, it's the complete early bird package, and that's $250. That's what tuition is. For a week of learning and fun, $250 is very cheap. In fact, I will tell you that it's a lot less money than it actually costs us to do this. We do this as an educational outreach, and in fact, we are a 501c3, which is a charitable educational organization. And in fact, we solicit your donations. If you like what we do at Camp American, we would ask you to make a tax-deductible donation to us. And you can do that right from the front page. But right now we're talking about tuition, and the tuition is only $250 until June 1st. That's a very good deal. After June 1st, it goes to $300 just because it costs us more money to make sure we have room and things after certain dates. There's also the possibility of putting down a $100 deposit. Right underneath the complete early bird package is a Camp American tuition deposit. We do need to have a minimum by June 1st, if you're going to reserve your early bird spot, we got to have the $100. You're going to have to sign up for the $100. That's the only way we can hold your spot. And then after that, you can, by June 9th, we need the remaining $150. Of course, after June 1st, that goes to $200. But for now, $150 by June 1st plus the $100 deposit will hold your spot at Camp American. Now, if you look again over there, on the right-hand side under store categories, you'll see other things. Group tuition packages. Yes, we do large groups. There's a very good break for large groups. You should probably give us a call at 614-893-5986. That is on the website, www.campamerican.com. We also do family tuition packages for large families. If you have three or more kids that you want to come to camp, yes, we do understand that that can be a financial burden, and we do provide pricing breaks for large families. We also provide large breaks for people who come and volunteer in the kitchen or to do other things around the camp. There are sometimes people come and we know who they are, and we've screened them well. They come and they can act as counselors or kitchen help or help around the camp. They will get a large tuition break for their kids. You should call us at, again, 614-893-5986. That's 614-893-5986. Or send me an email, director@campamerican.com. That's director@campamerican.com. And I can explain exactly what it takes to be a volunteer, sign up for camp, and get a tuition break, how much of a tuition break you get. Again, it is substantial. Now, to complete your registration, there's something else you're going to have to send to us, and that is a registration form. The registration form is available on the front page of the website. If you look down, there's a couple of pictures. There will be some picture boards that are flashing pictures of things that are going on. Some of the instructors, some of the people hanging around in camp, some of the students. And you'll see, look down below, it's in rather large type, printable copy of the 2012 Camp American flyer, printable copy of the 2012 Camp American registration form. You're going to have to download this and fill it out and send it back. Really, that's no big deal. Download it and mail it to us. If you want to make your deposit with that, rather than making it online, send us a check. If you want to pay your whole tuition, rather than paying it online, send us a check. This is not a problem. Again, also underneath is a printable copy of the 2012 Camp American Volunteer Registration Form. That's for those of you who want to volunteer for camp. Send us, download this, print it out, fill it out, send it back. And the address, of course, is listed below that. You can send it to that address, 4635 South Crest Drive, Louisville, Kentucky, 40215. And voila, you are registered for camp. We'll actually register you the minute you put your money in with your credit card. but we have to have that registration form or you are not officially registered. Okay, well, it looks like we're basically out of time for today. If you have any questions, go to www.campamerican.com. And again, we appreciate it. Be with us Monday for another Principles and Policies.